Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is once again AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm the net control operator for the Limark Technical Net. The Limark Technical Net has been going on for 43 odd years, and every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we take a seat in front of our radios to get together with the idea to kind of teach each other and learn from each other and be entertained by each other. As I've always said, if you're not having fun, you're doing it terribly, terribly wrong. So with that in mind, welcome back, everyone, who joined me tonight. I hope you'll be entertained and informed, and I hope others out there will inform me as well. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual link. Okay, if you need to reach me and you can't do it on the radio, then email is a good one. Those would be for what we used to call mailbag questions. Those are questions that you'd ordinarily ask during the technical net, but because you weren't able to get to the repeater, you couldn't ask them. So you could email them to me, read them, and answer them if it seems like a good question to discuss out there. And you can either listen to the audio stream or listen to the archived audio at a later time. Also, if you have a topic for discussion, occasionally technical things pop up into the popular press, and some of our participants are very knowledgeable about those subjects. They contact me and they say, I'd like to do 10, 15 minutes on such and such. And I say, yeah, sure. Other times, people are interested in the subject, but they don't want to do presentations. They want to discuss them, so they want to be part of a discussion. And occasionally, there are guys out there who don't know much about a subject, but they're curious and interested and want to hear other people discuss it. Also, we're always looking for technical puzzles. Those are mind teasers, hopefully of a technical basis, and something that can't be Googled the answer for, or can't Google the correct answer for in seconds. So if you have any of those, feel free to email me. Also, if you want Paul to be aware of some space or NASA-related story and to give his opinion, you could either contact him directly at spacenetreport@gmail.com, or you can email me and I'll relay it. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Let me drop for a sec. I, every week, kind of collect, cut and paste a bunch of interesting articles, YouTube, and all kinds of fun stuff, and I put it on what I call Roy's link page. You get there by typing in roy.ac2gs.com, and we keep it up for years. And it's available 24/7. So if you have nothing better to do someday and you're in front of a computer, type in roy.ac2gs.com and take a look at some of the links that I have available. I'll be alluding to some of them very soon into this technical deck. We have a chat room available. Sometimes it's been very, very busy. Lately it's been rather quiet. If you want to try it out, all you have to do is type into a browser, TechNet. You got to type in chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll take you to our chat room. As I mentioned earlier, we do offer an audio stream of the technical net. We keep it live the rest of the week, so you can get an internet stream of the Glen Oaks repeater. You get there by typing into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And I always like to promote Mike, AC2NJI, has archives of the technical net. They go as far back as September 2006, so please avail yourself of that. Anyway, so those are the usual links. Let me drop for a second, and I have a couple things I want to chat about before we go on to the main segment of the technical net. As always, it'll be my little chat, and then we will ask for questions and topics, and then at around 10:15, call WS2N, will give us the SpaceNet report, and I will return around 11 o'clock to tie it all up in a bow. Now, that's the plan. So let me drop for a second, and I'll be right back with what I want to tell you guys. Some might recall we were having a lot of different conversations last Sunday, which is loads of fun. and I made a comment that I was going to kind of look things up and learn more about these things, hopefully for next Sunday, and so it's next Sunday. Someone asked about using LITS wire for coaxial cables, and one of our participants, a good regular on the chat room, suggested that LITS wires are not really terribly effective beyond about 1 or 2 megahertz. So for the HF bands that hams use, it would not be of any worth. I did look them up. They do out there sell coax-style LITS wires. Again, they're designed to be used for lower frequency range. So below amateur radio bands, for the most part, you can actually buy coax-style LITS wire, and I have a link to it on my link page. Also, let me drop for a second, I'll give you the second thing. Also, part of the conversation last week was about the length of transmission lines and transmission theory and bird wattmeters. And, part of the manual discusses the fact that if you are not measuring from a 50-ohm load, the distance from the load in transmission line will affect the impedance reading, and so they suggested a uniform length of transmission line just to make sure that you have repeatable results. And so we were discussing that, and I think John made the point that bird watt meters are not strictly directly power measuring devices. They are voltage measuring devices, and power is calculated, and those the way it's calculated is sometimes is not as accurate as you would want to. We mentioned the bolometer, which is basically a kind of a calorimeter. It reads actually thermal energy as pure power. Anyway, I looked it up, and I didn't find anything other than what we had said, except that I came across what was probably some of the dumbest advice on a webpage, in which they asked the absurd question, is there an optimal length for your transmission line? And the only thing dumber than the question was the answer. The answer, the webpage said, was 18 feet. Yep, if you want the optimum transmission line, you have to measure 18 feet, and that's that. And then they compounded it with even more stupidity and said, by the way, don't if you have excess, because you didn't need 18 feet, don't just kind of put it any place, and certainly don't loop it one on top of the other. You're supposed to make it into a figure eight, because if you don't make it into a figure eight, then that will give you a high mismatch. Let me drop for a sec. Of course, the second nonsense I've heard on 75 meters occasionally, it comes from a complete lack of knowledge of how coaxial cables, that they are isolated, that they have a differential mode that doesn't interact externally, and that's why you can put a whole bunch of coax cables next to each other and not worry about any interaction, whereas open lines, you would need to worry a great deal. So you can basically put any extra wire in any place you want. You could loop it, you could loop-de-loop it, you could do anything you want with it for the most part, as long as it's not really tight corners where you might have some problems with the insulating material. So that was nonsense. But I kind of scratched my head, why would 18 feet be the best length of wire? And then I figured, let me think like a Simpsons band person. So I'm only thinking in terms of 11 meters. So if you think of 11 meters and you think of 18 feet, that's approximately half the wavelength in free space of 11 meters. The obvious problem is transmission wires have something called velocity factor. Your RF does not travel down your coax cable at the speed of light in the vacuum. And some coax cables have a velocity factor of 0.66, so they travel at around two-thirds the speed of light in the vacuum. So a half wavelength for the standard regular coax the CBR would use, the half wavelength would be 12 feet, not 18. So they got it wrong by simple math, and they got it wrong by the way that transmission lines work, and they just got it terribly all wrong. So I also linked that incredibly dumb webpage. So if you want to check it out and laugh, feel free. Anyway, anyone with any comments before we go to the main sector section of this TechNet?
W2BZ.
Yes, Rich.
The thing about length of coax and coax next to another coax brought something to mind. If you have coax coming from your antenna in a straight line, and then along the way, you know, let's say midway to your receiver, the coax gets jumbled up. You know how coax and wire have a tendency to do that, to get jumbled up. I always wondered if that jumbled up part of the coax impacts the transmission line at all, or if it's, you know, too little or not significant enough to really impact anything. Is it a must to keep transmission line straight without any kinks and turns and bow ties and all that stuff?
Well, assuming that you're not using it as part of a radiating source, because, you know, some antenna designs do not RF choke lengths of coax cable, and so they're part of the antenna system. And so you have to kind of be aware of their height and location and, you know, where they are in space. But assuming that it's strictly a transmission line and not a counterpoise radiative element, it has no factor whatsoever, unless you have such sharp kinks in it that the dielectric material is pushing the center wire towards the edges, and then you might have a slight impedance mismatches in that area. But as long as they're not truly mechanically kinked, having them messed up just is an aesthetic thing. It's not a technical thing.
That's what I assumed, never hearing anything to the contrary. So you just confirmed it. Good. Thanks, Roy.
You're welcome, Rich. Once again, I'm AC2GS. This is the Weimar Technical Net. If anyone has any kind of opinions or comments to make about what I just mentioned, feel free right now. Very well. So we will go on with the main portion of the technical net. Everyone out there, if you have any technical questions, I would prefer the amateur radio ones first, but we'll no doubt have time. I'm open to any discussion of any science and or technology, and more than willing to attempt at trying to explain things or at least point you in the general direction of good information out there on the Internet. So if you're out there and you got either a question or a comment or a topic for discussion, please feel free, hit that push to talk, give me your first name and your call sign.
AC2,
Robert. Hello, John. Anyone else out there?
This is Kilo Delta 2, Whiskey November Alpha.
Yes, what's your first name, sir?
Handle here is Sean, Sierra Echo Alpha November.
Okay, Sean, you're down on the list. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
Whiskey 2, Bravo Sean.
Okay, Rich, I have you down, but someone was doubling with Rich. I couldn't make out his call sign, so the guy that tried to transmit just a few seconds ago, please repeat.
ADTDU, Alex.
Okay, Alex recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list before we get the show going? Okay, maybe later on there'll be more people. So, John, I think you brought up the question about the bird watt meter and the comment about half wavelength of a transmission line.
Yeah, that was me last week. Let me make sure I had it this week. And good evening to you, Roy, everyone else on the net. My question this week is, and bear with me, hopefully I explain it well, is if I put two signals of opposite, polarity into a wire, that's a short circuit, right? If they're 180 degrees out of phase, that is a short circuit. But when we transmit into the air, when we put a signal into the air, and let's say either through multipath or some other method, that these two signals arrive at your antenna in opposite phase, what's happening there? Where does that energy go? Why is there a null in the airwaves at that particular place and moment in time? Does energy get dissipated in some way? How does this cancellation work? And let me know if that question doesn't make sense, because I don't know if I'm explaining it well. AC2, GS in the TechNet, KC2, SHO.
So, John, I think I get the gist of what you're asking. And just to make life very complicated, because I brought up transmission line theory, in the case of transmission lines, you don't necessarily just have one current. You could have two currents. That's the whole point of the directional coupler. You can measure the current going in one direction and the current going in the other direction. So you have two sets, a pair of wires, and you have two currents going in opposite directions. Just to make life confusing. But to get to the main gist of what you were getting at, what happens when, say, due to a very bizarre case of multipath, you have the same signal getting to the antenna, but from different distances, and they happen to coincide to, rather than additively, sum up, they interfere with each other and they know each other. Where does the energy go? My surmise would be that they would simply be expended as part of thermal waste energy, that they would negate each other when they were inducing currents, opposing currents on the antenna. And those would just kind of short themselves out before they got to the transmission line.
Okay, interesting. So it is a short of sorts, but I guess maybe to further muddy the question is there's two scenarios. One, whether your antenna is there or not, there must be a cancellation in free space. And then there's a condition where your antenna is there, where a voltage is either generated or not because of this phenomena. I don't know that there's more to ask there, or maybe I'm not smart enough to ask what the next question is, but is there a difference in what's happening there?
Well, I have a problem, though, with photons interacting in free space alone. All of the experiences I've ever read about of the interaction of electromagnetic energy requires some medium of interface. So in other words, for us, that's our antenna. The electromagnetic waves induce currents in our antennas. The currents feed down from the transmission line into our receivers. Can get kind of zen-ish and say, what's the sound of one hand clapping? If you don't have anything to interact with the photons, they simply disperse and fade away as they spread farther and farther into a larger volume of space.
Sorry, let me
make sure I have it again. Turn off my ID for a little while so it doesn't interrupt the conversation. But I guess that's interesting. Maybe I need to understand more about what's happening with the electromagnetic spectrum in that scenario where the antenna is not present. I'm definitely not versed enough to know what the next comment or question would be, but that'll give me something to chew on for sure. I appreciate the enlightenment in this area.
No problem. I mean, we have kind of asserted this issue many, many times before. Is there a maximum, you know, about the lack of true direct interaction of photons or electromagnetic waves without some interposing medium. And we've kind of gone to the extremes of physics to show how theoretically if you created a photon of high enough energy where it could possibly decay out into something else, it is possible that it does not require some kind of interaction to simply spontaneously decay. But, you know, you're talking about ultra, ultra high energy gamma rays for things like that. Otherwise, as far as physics is aware, if you take a laser pointer and point it into a volume of space bereft of any object, so it's not going to get absorbed by any molecules, it theoretically should go on forever and ever and ever. I mean, it's going to spread out, so it's going to be rather thin, but it never ceases unless it gets reflected, refracted, absorbed, scattered by something else other than electromagnetic waves.
Okay. So I guess that makes me wonder, is this happening with light all around us all the time, this cancellation? In other words, if I turn a bunch of light bulbs on in a room, is this happening and the wavelength is just so small we can't perceive it with the human eye? Or even in multipass with one light bulb with reflection. You know, are these things happening there as well? But again, it's such a minute scale that we just can't recognize it. Is that also true of that portion of the electromagnetic spectrum?
I would say yes. I mean, most light that's commercially used is incoherent, so it's much more random. But I am sure that incidentally, there is the occasional negative interference between two light waves. Again, it's only a factor if it hits a sensor detector like our optic nerve. So I'm sure there is a very small amount of interference, negative interference with other waves of light, but so fleeting and incidental that it would be very difficult to probably even measure with advanced equipment. Not to mention our optic nerve allows for all kinds of tricks, you know, like our inability to pick up flicker that's faster than a certain frequency.
BDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
Yeah, well, to really see that interference pattern with light, the light has to be a single frequency. This is what causes sometimes if you see laser light to have that speckled appearance. Sometimes I've been at a grocery store where the laser scanner, you see it reflecting off something and it has a speckled kind of appearance. That's like a surface interference pattern where the light is interfering with itself, causing light and dark regions. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's where you see the optimized version of constructive and destructive interference. But that isn't to say that even incoherent multi-band electromagnetic waves do not have a very small but a non-zero amount of waves interfering with each other just by random happenstance. Some of them happen to be the same frequency. Some of them happen to be 180 degrees out of phase with each other.
Yeah, but white light or sunlight or whatever is so broadband, I don't think you get too much noticeable interference. You might get some, but it's so broadband that it really... not going to be much. Incidentally, like in the case of phased vertical antennas, you have two antennas driven 90 degrees out of phase and a quarter wave apart. So in the direction of a lagging antenna, you get a maximum. But in the direction of the leading antenna, the phase leading antenna, you're going to get cancellation. But it's the cancellation of the electric field. The energy there is being canceled in the sense that the electric field is going to zero because of a 180 degree phase difference in that direction. Okay, but again, we're kind of veering into the theoretical. In the theoretical world, I agree with you entirely. I think it's a cosine function. So 0 degrees, the cosine of zero is one. At 90 degrees, the cosine of 90 degrees is zero. But in the real world, you can have a 90 degrees polarization angle between two antennas, and you can still receive the signal. It's not a strong signal, but it's not a zero, stress signal. So it's in the theoretical, if you're playing with cosine functions, it should be zero, but it's not. It's probably you'll have something like a 30 dB drop or something, but 30 dB is not zero. It's about 1,000, which is small, but still not a zero. But, yeah, I agree with you on the first part. I never meant to give people the impression that the amount of interference one would see with incandescent or multiband light is at all significant. Just it would be non-zero. What minuscule microscopic fraction of the illumination would happen by sheer luck to interfere with the other one, you know, would be so small, I don't even know if you could measure it. But yeah, I don't think it's significant. I've seen interference patterns, slit lamp experiments are loads of fun to do, and confuses the heck out of people about quantum mechanics. There's an experiment where they replace the slit lamp, the two slits with... instead of light waves, they use electrons. Electrons show the same interference pattern. And then there's an experiment where they just shoot one electron at a time so that it can't interfere with another electron, and it still shows you the same interference pattern. So one photon or one electron going supposedly through two slits simultaneously somehow gives you an interference pattern. Which only goes to show how weird quantum mechanics is.
Yeah, that is weird.
Yeah, I mean, we've spent many an hour on the technical net. I have with Dick discussing wave-particle duality and pilot waves as a reason for why waves act like particles and particles act like waves. And it's an interesting field of physics that usually gives more than a few people migraines.
N2BHD, Mojo with a comment.
Yes, Dan.
Hey, good afternoon. Oh, it's 6:30 p.m. here. Good evening from Nebraska. I'm Mobile in the panhandle of Nebraska. I may lose connectivity. I may not. I have a weird topic I'd like to bring up when I have a chance. I just like to wiggle my way in and say that. And if I have time, I'll listen. And when you can get me in, let me enter a topic. Back to net control.
Okay, Ken, I'd love to take your topic. If you could tell me approximately how much time you think you have with us tonight.
Oh, I'd say about half an hour. I'll be listening for about half an hour until I arrive at my destination. So I'll be... And the topic is about SCADA, Supervisory Control Data Acquisition. It's about the electrical grid out here in my town of Alliance. what just happened. They went into a full total blackout on purpose for 9 hours. And I wanted to share what went on in the town when they threw the big switch. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Ted. I'll shoehorn you in sometime in the next half hour. You just say to us, and I'll get back to you, okay?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. This is N2BHD Mobile. Listening.
Okay, very good. So getting back to you, John. Any other points you want to offer? Again, I want to make sure everyone listening understands that I'm doing it as much as an intellectual exercise as anything. You are not going to see a perceptible interference pattern from incandescent and incoherent light. You will see wonderful examples for using coherent light. But even though you don't see a perfectly lovely example, in the little teeny areas of time intervals, there are episodes of interference because waves interfere with each other, and light is an electromagnetic wave. And so they are capable of reinforcing amplitude and of negating amplitude. So it's out there, but you would need a very sophisticated means to measure any fluctuations due to it, and they would be quite transitory. So, John, back to you.
Oh, no, that's it. That was my only comment. That was my only comment. Go ahead.
Okay, no problem. I was actually addressing
does this mean that more robust broadbanded signals would experience less problems with multipath? I mean, we know that's true, but is this the reason why? Is this one of the reasons why a broader banded signal? I don't mean more frequencies on a broader band. I mean the signal itself, if it's broader band, is that the reason that signal is more robust because of things like this? And are there more? I guess there's probably more to it than.
Well, in the case of transmissions, you have, although they're not coherent, they are single frequency. So you sort of have pseudo-coherent broadcast transmission. So I guess you could make the case that a multipath vagaries have less of an impact on a broader frequency range where the distances that they would negatively interfere with each other would be different along the range of bandwidth being transmitted. I don't know if that really translates to any kind of measurable improvement, though.
Okay. Sounds very sensical to me. You know, I hear things over the years but don't have a specific a degree or education in this world, so it's all just what I've learned along the career path and what I've heard in places like the TechNet. So sometimes I just want to tie it all together and try to fill in the gaps where maybe it hasn't been told. Well, real good. Thank you for the comments, Roy, and I will definitely read more and maybe think deeper about it. Appreciate you running the TechNet and all you guys do. You're on. Well, as long as I'm around to remember to do it, maybe I'll make a cron tab one of these days to do it automatically. But here in northern New Mexico, covering most of Los Alamos County and Santa Fe, so maybe we'll get some attention out here if people are listening, and maybe they'll have some questions for us. Thanks for everything, and back to you, AC2 GS from KC2 SHO.
AC2GS. Well, you're certainly welcome, John, and anyone out there is welcome to join us. That's why we have all the links that we have. We have our Echo link. We have I always lock on that other link that was set up. And we have IRLP, obviously, that you're coming through. So the more the merrier. So thank you for participating tonight, John. Sean, just curious, are you rushed for time, or could Ken from Nebraska
who doesn't have much more time to spend with us, move a little bit up the line for you. John, are you out there? KD2WNA, I think it is. Well, I guess Sean stepped away from the radio. I'm sure Rich won't mind if I put Ken in Sean's spot, because Ken isn't going to have that much time to play with us tonight. So, Ken, you're on.
Thank you. This is N2BHC, Stroke Mobile. Super entertaining segment. So, out here in the Midwest, my town of Alliance is pretty isolated. It's about 30, 40 miles from any other town. So tonight, they did a power outage schedule from 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. So could you imagine if they cut all the power somewhere else, say Chicago, for 9 hours? I mean, everything went out. Cell phone towers, everything. There was no 911 capability. You know, everything, everybody acted normal, walking around with the dog, waving hello, out the park playing Frisbee, walking with the baby. I was out cutting the lawns, me and my brother, front and back lawn, trimming, edging, everything. Everything, no 911 capability even, like I said. No cell phones. I couldn't use the cell phones until I left the area. And the only thing that worked was amateur radio in your car. So it was very unusual to have a scheduled outage. And the reason why they did the outage, they didn't tell anybody, but I knew why. I found out. It was SCADA. The town is controlled by federal SCADA function. And SCADA is a remote-controlled operated, all of our utilities, major utilities, sewage, water, electric, are all remotely controlled by the federal government in Virginia through the SCADA network operation. And they were doing a load test on our electric grid for the future EV requirements for the electric vehicles. If the average amount of people and Alliance, Nebraska were to buy EVs as they have to have in a certain period of time, would the electric grid be able to handle a load? So tonight was a load test, believe it or not, a 9-hour load test. I find that to be very interesting also. Back to net control. What are your thoughts on that? Over to net control.
Okay, that is certainly interesting. I guess you could get away with it out there. If you tried to do it in the metropolitan area, you would be sued for the next 30 years. Everyone and their brother would sue you for all kinds of things. So I guess they felt that the low population density and the general fact that none of those guys are multi-billionaires who own senators and such live out there and let them get away with it. We've discussed on the TechNet in the past the problems with modern technology causing newer problems. Unfortunately, I think people are more concerned that the move away from gas ranges and gas ovens into electric ranges and electric ovens is going to put massive demand on the power grid. I would agree with the guys who conceived of this experiment that I think electric vehicles have a much greater impact as they grow in size of wreaking havoc with our utility electric grid and such. So in one way, I'm glad that they're thinking ahead that way. In the other, it's unfortunate that you guys had to pay the price for that. Because, like I said, only a raving lunatic would suggest doing it in Manhattan or Queens or Brooklyn.
Nobody lives out here except me. That's on the net. And to let you know, it's almost like something out of a horror movie that you would throw the switch on a little town in the Midwest. You know, and you would think people would run around. It's perfect for scenario for rioting and looting, but nothing happens. Everybody goes about their life, you know. So it is, and they're just testing the grid. But anywhere else, there would be bands of looters running around going crazy. You can't even dial 911, you know. Nobody has a house phone anymore. So when you go to your cell phone, you get no reception. Absolutely none. So now you're under the gun. Here we go. Literally under the gun. So the strange thing is that you don't even know this is happening where you live. But it's happening all over the Midwest. And I'm not a conspiracy guy. I could care less what happens, you know. I go back up to the reservation like I'm going now, and I live in peace and comfort up there. Nobody bothers us up there. But I live in a sovereign nation 5 days a week called the Ogallala Sioux Tribe, you know. But down here, they're going completely crazy, cutting people's electricity off because they have a system called SCADA. They put in utility systems in all these small towns that couldn't afford upgrades. So the federal government came around and threw SCADA equipment in, which is remote-controlled equipment, which they have supervisory control over in a central location in Virginia. And they are able to throw the switch, so to speak, in Virginia for all your utilities. Then the catch was that they put your utilities at free. Now, a lot of people don't know this even exists. And it does exist. And every small town in the Midwest that needed new utilities bent over and went for it. And our power is provided by WAPA. If you look up WAPA, that's called Western Area Power Authority.
Are you there, Ken? I think you dropped out at the end. Oh, well, very interesting information. Unfortunately, Ken probably reached the edge of his cell tower access for his cell phone that he echo-links into our repeater. So if you're out there, Ken, thanks. We appreciate it. We feel bad for the people who had to deal with it. And things like this, usually are not publicized because these are Achilles' heels. These are points where sabotage can be performed. So there are a lot of these pressure points that are kind of kept as obscure as federal agencies can keep them so that people don't know where to kick us or shoot us or such. So we're probably not going to learn a great deal about these facilities for fear that hackers will do their evil stuff.
KD2VHD.
Yes, Jim.
Interesting story. Sounds vaguely familiar. Are we sure we know who the hackers are and who the protectors are? It's vaguer every day, I think. Sorry to throw it at you. I know not everybody enjoys that way of thinking, but I'm eerie about big switches on my wires. I'll leave it at that. Good net, Roy. Back to that.
Well, you know, I think there's unfortunately two massively different ways of attacking grid systems. The old-fashioned way is done locally. There have been groups of people who were demonstrating their dislike with other people by shooting into generators and screwing around with them. That's the old-school method. I think the finesse of software hacking is pretty much a government-sponsored one. If you look into it, you will find that Russia has a whole army group and third-party contractors. I think the Chinese don't really go through third-party contractors. It's all army. And I'm sure we have our group of hackers, too. Everyone has their group of hackers. So there's sort of two ways of attacking things. The boots on the ground are usually homegrown lunatics. But I think most of the hackers tend to be more international.
Thank you, Roy, for the comeback. I'm picking up a phone call. Back to that, KD2VHD.
Okay, very good. Let me try one more last time in case Sean was called away and came back. Sean, if you're still out there, do you want to ask a question? I guess not. Well, it's your turn, Rich.
Okay. As you know, we were talking during the week about my wonderful, incredibly amazing magnetic loop that I built. I've worked the world with it so far, with just 100 watts, if that. And it's just blown my mind. I mean, I know I'm boorish about it because it's all I ever talked about, but in 35 years since I've owned my Kenwood 440, I have never heard louder signals. Never. In 35 years, no matter what the propagation is, and I'm talking about in the early 90s when the sunspot cycle was through the roof, I still never heard louder signals. Anyway, it gets me from 10 meters to 30 meters, but not 40 meters. And as we were talking during the week, I asked you what would happen if I added another loop, an additional loop, could that get me to 40 meters? And you said, yes, it could, but you'd also have to change the capacitor range, the range of the capacitor. And that's what I don't understand. Why wouldn't just doubling the size of the loop get me to 40 meters without a change of capacitor?
Okay, AC2GS, by the way. You could just kind of plug it into to Mike's spreadsheet. If you double the inductance, it still is not going to be enough. You are going to have to increase the capacitance as well. And usually the few magnetic loops that I've seen that use that philosophy, either you could build a very, very big and difficult to manage loop, or you can coil, say, two loops in series around, you know, like a little bit of a spiral. I have seen as much as four loop spiral configuration for magnetic loops. But inevitably, you still have to increase the tuning capacitor because you just can't physically add enough inductance that doesn't introduce too much additional insertion loss and make it a complete loss, you know, a premise. So as far as I'm aware, you know, you could plug it into Mike's equation. You inevitably have to increase the capacitance even though you've increased the inductance a little bit. I don't know. I can't really think of the math offhand, but, you know, think of it in terms of you're doubling the you're having the frequency, so are you probably going to need to it probably requires tuning something to the square of that, so four times the amount of inductance and capacitance and such, and just by doubling the inductor is not going to be anywhere near enough to have a resonant magnetic loop. So that's what I'm thinking.
All right, since it's not that big a jump, though, from 30 meters to 40 meters, do you think there might be a chance I could get to 40 without changing the capacitor, or do you think no way at all?
Okay, I was waiting for the static to drop. I don't think so. You could try, but I don't think it will happen. Effectively, you're going to have to bite the bullet and have a more significant tuning capacity, and that's going to increase your insertion loss. It's going to decrease your efficiency. Usually magnetic loops are most efficient at the shortest frequency you can get them with the smallest capacitance that you can get them. As you make the inductive, as you make the loop longer, you introduce more insertion losses, surface resistance, and you ultimately need a higher capacitance, which introduces even more loss. So I you could try it, certainly, but I don't think you'd be successful.
I have to play around with the with my spreadsheet, but that begs the question. Could just a bigger, quote-unquote, bigger capacitor, wider-range capacitor, get me to 40 meters, you know, without the need for lengthening the inductor? Anyway, it's one of those things I think that has to be played with. I don't want to be broken now because this is just, I'm just like terrified by it. It's 1.5 inches.
Rich, I'm sorry to say that you've been about 90-95% noisy. You've dropped out of the repeater at least a dozen times because we've talked about this before. I kind of was able to piece together the pauses, and I pretty much know what you said. Earlier on, you asked the question that would you be able to tune a magnetic loop by just increasing the capacitor on the variable capacity tuner? And the answer is yes. Anything ultimately can be tuned. I've mentioned in the past my lovely little Palstar antenna tuner could tune a doorknob. There are tunable dummy loads. That's the problem, though. It's not only tuning it, you tune it in a way your energy is transferred in an efficient way and not too much of it is used up in waste heat. And as you increase the capacitance in order to tune a given loop at a lower frequency, you diminish the efficiency of the antenna to a greater and greater extent. It is theoretically possible to take a standard 10 to 40 meter magnetic loop and swap out the capacitor for one much higher maximum capacitance and tune it for 80. You don't see too many people doing it because, you know, like a 160 meter hamstick stuck to the fender of a car, the efficiencies are probably significantly less than 0.1%. So it's not worth the trouble. But you can do it.
All right, I'll give it a try. At least I have an antenna to work with. By the way, I switched over to Selden. Is my signal any better coming off of Selden?
Yes, it is much, 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 much better. You may be about 5-10% background noise, but minuscule.
Okay, don't know what happened with Middle Island, but I usually hit Middle Island much better than Selden. So if I'm coming in okay on Selden, but not on Middle Island, let me just real quick for the people, the repeater people who might be listening, let me just switch back to Middle Island a second.
Okay, here I'm back on Middle Island, and I'm just wondering if the noise is still on the board.
Yep, it went back to being noisy as heck.
Okay, now back on Selden. Don't know what's happening. But anyway, thanks for your answer, Roy. I will continue on. Anybody who's in a restricted space who wants an amazing HF antenna, I'm good on, just email me, and I will tell you how I made this thing. And with what components. I am now a day away from remotely tuning the capacitor on Wi-Fi on my phone with a little controller board and an app that a guy in California has put together. I've been playing with it without it being hooked up to the capacitor, and it's wonderful. And the thing's only $79, including shipping. Gives me Wi-Fi control of the capacitor, so I could skip from any band to any band that I want, and then tune it remotely. Just unbelievable. All in all, the antenna cost me about $200. And anybody I could hear, I could work. I've worked the other day Serbia and the Bahamas, all over the place. So it's been, but it's also very directional. So I'm going to need a rotator down the line. Back to net, W2BC.
Okay, very good, Rich. I look forward to your future report. I'm going to be curious about how the Wi-Fi connection works, if it's rock steady or goes in and out, if there's any kind of delays, or if the positions of the capacitor are repeatable over time. So a lot of little details. I'm looking forward to them.
Comment, KC2SHO.
Yes, John. Yes, John, please go ahead.
When it comes to the subject of tuning up any old random wire or a doorknob, like your example, K2RIW would always say something along the lines of, regardless of the size of the antenna, when you have it tuned properly, the capture area is, maybe he didn't say identical, maybe he did, but I was wondering if you could, you know, fill us back in on that. In other words, you say the efficiency is down, but if the capture area is the same, how does that relate? Why is the efficiency down, but the capture area is the same? KC2GS, KC2SHO.
Okay, I mean, I had this conversation with Dick many a time. What he was saying was the aperture is equivalent, because the aperture is indifferent to the length of the radiator. It's only due to the resonant wavelength of the antenna. It could be a mechanically short, electrically lengthened one, and it'll still have the same aperture. And the envelope, I think he said that there might be 1 or 2 dB of loss from a full size one. But what I would always try not to annoy him with is that as you shrink these things down, you change other aspects of an antenna. The aperture might be identical, but the radiation resistance keeps going down. Now, the radiation resistance of a center-fed dipole in free space is 73 ohms. That's what gives it its impedance. At resonance, the impedance is a real resistance number. But as you do these shortening things, your radiation resistance shrinks more and more and more and more and more. And in the case of magnetic loops that we've talked a great deal about, you're left with a radiation resistance of less than a tenth of an ohm. So insertion losses of antenna couplers, antenna tuners, transmission lines, and just the connections between electrical components have an enormous impact in the efficiency of the signal transfer to the radiator. And that's where you get burnt. You might have the same aperture area, volume, but you don't have the same efficiency, and a lot more of your energy is going up as waste heat rather than being radiated as the radiation resistance of RF just kind of pouring away from the radiator.
Okay, I think that makes sense. Again, like most subjects that I'm not that smart on, I will 2 on this and read some more. KC2 GS, KC2 SHO, thank you for the insight.
You're welcome, John. I mean, if you have nothing better to do someday, just kind of Google radiation resistance. There's a lot of stuff written on the subject, and it's the basis of